part two of his.
Right. So I'm just going to start where I left off more or less last time and just remind you that I finally managed to get high latitudes warm enough to match paleoclimate proxies, but in the process, I sort of cooked the tropics and did all sorts of mean and nasty things between 30 north and 30 south latitude. And I think there's a possibility that something nasty did happen, but it's a long way from being something that I feel comfortable with saying actually happened. But I guess what's interesting to me is if you want to avoid this particularly mean and nasty state, you have to find some way of increasing heat transport beyond what happens in any GCM I've ever seen, or increase ocean heat transport, and we have no evidence from any ocean model that ocean heat transport increases substantially under these conditions. Or there's some radiation feedback that happens, and nobody's ever really found one after much looking that does what we want, warm the poles without warming the tropics. So I can ramp up CO2 and actually get something that looks kind of okay, except in the tropics. And this is just sort of a generalization of a problem that we've had for a long time. I'm just taking it to the nth degree, really. One way forward is to revisit this issue of ocean heat transport and ask yourself, is there a way to increase ocean heat transport that's not completely ad hoc? In the past 10 years, what people have done is they take a slab ocean model, it's 50 meters thick, and it has a diffusion coefficient in it. It's basically a frying pan, and you just crank up the conductivity of the frying pan and transport more heat to the poles. And they say, oh, that solves the problem. And of course, it totally neglects the point, you know, which is that the ocean dynamics, if you actually look at them, don't give you anything like a more conductive, in the lateral direction, ocean in a warmer world. But there was an interesting idea that Mitch Lyle pointed out. He used a very simple model to show that it was feasible if the vertical mixing coefficient had a certain dependence on the static stability that it might actually increase the meridional overturning stream function, increase the vigor of the equator to pole circulation, if you will, under certain conditions of warming. And he played around with that. It's just a toy model. It's an interesting idea. But he didn't really have a mechanism for doing this, and it was just sort of a toy. But it's a good thought experiment. Anyway, Carrie Emanuel then published one paper in which he said something really quite crazy, which is that he thought that he could explain all of the vertical mixing in the ocean, and therefore a significant part of the ocean heat transport in the modern world, with hurricanes. And of course, essentially the physical oceanographic community, modulo like two people, said, well, Carrie works on hurricanes. He's saying hurricanes govern the climate system. Yeah, okay, we're just gonna ignore that. But I thought it was really interesting for two reasons. First of all, his hypothesis suggested that hurricane mixing and therefore hurricane-induced ocean heat transport would increase in a warmer world, and so I liked that. And also I knew that this mechanism wasn't in any climate model out there because the climate models don't get hurricane winds nearly at the right magnitude. So it kind of matched what to me were the criteria I had laid out at the end of my dissertation saying, well, if anything is gonna work, it's gotta be something that you don't really see today, otherwise it would already be in the models. And it can't be really in the models today. And it has to have some sort of physical basis for getting stronger in a warmer world. So I kind of liked that, and I decided to work on that. And this is just a sort of a schematic representation of the toy model that he worked this stuff out in. You can think about this as increasing CO2 along this axis, and you can think about this as high latitude temperatures. And what's interesting in his very simple model, and I'm not really going to go through the details, but we're going to go through the underlying physical picture in quite some depth. The basic result of this simple toy model, I was probably done in MATLAB, was just that you have these transitions in climate state as you raise, we'll call this CO2. And what's really happening here is you go from a world with almost no hurricane mixing to one with sort of modern day hurricane mixing, and then in a warmer world you have far more intense integrated mixing, and you end up with this world with a sudden polar warming, and it actually comes more or less at the expense of the tropics. So that looks pretty good to me as an explanation of the Eocene. It should be disturbing to anyone who thinks about the future if you believe this toy model, and I would say that almost nobody does.
So do you have physical argument for why?
Yes, and that we're going to step through that. But I just wanted to show you, this was an intriguing plot. Whenever you see something like this, if you think it has any reality, it's an interesting thing.
Just say though, I mean, this is based on an ODE model in which none of the physics is explicitly represented. You just assume certain power laws for all the
absolutely.
And there's no
it was a toy model that nobody believes, but it was interesting.
Are you going to say a little bit more about, I mean, the reason people are skeptical is not because Kerry is a hurricane guy and Kerry is respected and that's not the issue. The issue is that there were physical reasons to be skeptical. Are you going to talk about this?
Sure. Yeah, well, we're going to go through this. So, but I'll tell you, it really is because he's a hurricane guy and oceanographers don't believe him. Because I've sat in the audience while he's talking and I literally hear one physical oceanographer turn to another and say, ha, that's so funny. He thinks everything is hurricane.
I mean, I think some people do this, but the better physical oceanographers have physical arguments, what the problem is with Kerry's argument, and they're very concrete, having to do with geostrophic adjustment in the wake.
Yeah. Certainly, Raff has some very good arguments. He's open-minded enough. But you could phrase the general problem of ocean mixing just as this. In the standard picture of the thermal haline circulation, which is really sort of a very, very silly cartoon, it's everyone always talks about how dense water sinks in the North Atlantic, and we think we know that. Dense water sinks. That's great. But this is a little bit of an odd thing, and many people have tended not to remark on this. Why is there supposedly dense water that's then rising, right? It's not exactly obvious that should happen. In fact, you can imagine a world, and this is, I mean, this was already touched on. What day was that, earlier this week? I can't even remember. But just the issue is, why is it that the dense water doesn't just sink, fill up the ocean, and it basically just sits there, at least until diffusive time scales cause it to upwell out? So it's an interesting question. A lot of people have worked on various parts of this, starting really with Monk, although Stommel was definitely aware of the problem. But at some point, you have to take dense water and convert it into a more buoyant water mass class. And so there's a lot of different conceptual pictures for how this might be done. I mean, I guess we could just look at this picture, which is sort of the original Stommel picture, more or less. Dense water sinks at high latitudes. And in his very, very crude, very toy way, he just imagined that there was some amount of mixing somewhere, and it had to be, in his very simple model, in the tropics somewhere to make up make up for the creation of dense water. You have to remove dense water. And so in the original Stommel model, even though everyone forgets it, there's a little propeller blade that he puts in. He even estimates how much that propeller blade has to mix in order to sustain an overturning circulation. Much more recently, a variety of people, most of whom have been or are now at GFDL, have proposed a different conceptual picture where, the dense water tends to sink, say, in the northern high latitudes, but most of it comes up in the Southern Ocean, and that's all driven by upwelling. And then it returns, it makes this kind of return journey, at least conceptually, in the Ekman layer, although that doesn't mean it actually has to be in the Ekman layer, but it's driven by Ekman layer dynamics. And actually, there's a lot of argument about which of these pictures is right, and as Tapio noted earlier, sometimes it's just seems to be arguing and not necessarily based on, you know, always the soundest science. The picture that I want to state, and I think it's the one that the field is evolving to, is probably there's elements of both of these that are right, that you don't really have to say that one happens and the other one doesn't. And certainly that's the viewpoint I'm going to take. And you can work out a more detailed budget and try and understand, not quite in such a toy way, how all of these play out together. And then you realize that you have to have some diapicnal mixing to turn Antarctic bottom water to more of an intermediate water mass. You have to deal differently with the abyssal stratification. But then at some point, you actually have to have some water mass conversion from this kind of intermediate water mass up through the thermocline. And it's really this part of the budget that's of interest to me. And we can talk about the magnitude of that, but based on tracer budget studies and on through looking through fluxes through control volumes analytically and in models and in data, actually this flux has to be something like 30 sverdrups in addition to everything that's happening here in the Southern Ocean. And that's actually surprising sometimes even to the people who derive that number is so big. This is just to give you an idea why all this is so important. This is vertical diffusion on this axis, and this is a fully dynamical model, but it's a simplified domain. Jeff Ballas's calculation. And one of these is with wind forcing, and one of them is without. And you could look at the difference. And this is some measure of the meridional overturn stream function, thing that goes like this. So you see, you know, people argue about this, what the exact value of the power law is, and the degree to which winds are important, and other things. But in general, this at least tells you that vertical diffusion is enormously important for determining things like the net meridional flow in the ocean.
Do you have the same kind of flow for heat flux rather than mass flux?
I will show later on some things that have to do with heat transport. When you do, the problem is almost nobody does that, and it's really unfortunate because, you know, they like to say that, well, since heat transport is basically this times the temperature gradient, we can estimate the changes in ocean heat transport if we know this. But of course, if there's increased ocean heat transport, you change the temperature gradient, so all of a sudden you can't make those statements. I'll show you my own results. Oleg Senko actually has some nice studies where he's looked at ocean heat transport as you do changes like this, but it's not nearly as big a parameter space.
Well, some part of the heat transport anyway, the Gaia part is not.
Yes and no. Actually, all of the heat transport is affected because it's essentially any diaphenol mixing leads to a flux, even in the what you would want to think of as being the upper part of the ocean that's mostly wind driven. But it does actually change all of the terms.
Well, I guess it depends where the maximum is. I mean, if you have a wind driven flow that has a shallow return flow above the maximum of the stream function you're plotting here, then it wouldn't be reflected in this only partial.
Well, it would be. Have you ever read the McWilliams 95 paper about the warm water sphere budget? That one's a good one to look at because he basically talks about very explicitly the 20 degree isotherm mixing across that is what everything else is sensitive to. Now, that was an uncoupled model, so the inferences about ocean heat transport are weak, but it really does get at the real importance of essentially this water mass and the diaphenol mixing across it.
That's true, but there's mixing and mixing, so there's simply diffusivity here, and then there's more explicit mixing that comes from the bondal layer and so forth. That's not
right.
Reflected
in diffusivity. Right, I agree. I think more of these issues will come up as I go through some of these figures. And then we'll just talk about them. So conceptually, this mixing is coming in, if you just sort of average over the whole world, through wind and through tides. And this is creating a whole set of internal waves that have interesting dynamics. They can propagate horizontally, they can propagate vertically, and they can even be advected by the geostrophic currents, although a lot of people like to ignore that. And it involves some sort of cascade of variance from a larger scale down to a smaller scale, or eventually this dissipation. So one of the most interesting things about this is when you go and you measure the diaphenol diffusivity, in this case, it's using tracer studies where you go and inject some tracer and you come back a couple weeks later and you see how much it's mixed. Or you can look at essentially the variance of temperature on very small scales or variance in density on small scales and estimated diffusivity. You get more or less the same number. But here, this is from Greg et al. In 2003 in Nature. And this is a figure from, I think it was Garrett's News and Views on this article. Should have put that in, I forgot. So these are all upper ocean measurements. So this is a essentially ignoring all of the deep abyssal mixing in the bottom three and a half, 4 kilometers of the ocean, and really focusing on just sort of the upper 500 meters or so, outside of the boundary layer, but above the abyss. And what you see is that at low latitudes, I'll ignore this data point because they did, at low latitudes, you get values of something like 10 to the minus 6 meters squared per second. And at higher latitudes, you tend to get much higher estimates. And this more or less agreed with a certain set of theories about how internal waves end up being affected by latitude. They're affected by more than one thing. One of them is stratification. But there is a term in the overall equation which is related to latitude. And the whole theory is extremely complex, which is another way of saying I don't particularly understand it. It's essentially a ray tracing based theory, that much I get. How the latitude comes in is never entirely clear to me. But both theory. Yeah, I mean, it's there's a dependence on F, but why it's in there, I mean, you know, there's an N and an F, and there's always an N and an F and everything. Exactly how it ends up in there, I've never particularly understood, even though I had sand flat tape crossed for me for 5 years, but never quite understood it. Anyway, the point is both in data and in theory, and this is why this was a Nature paper, there's evidence for, in low latitudes, below about 25 degrees, for much less vertical mixing or diapicnal mixing in the upper ocean. Now, one of the things that's especially interesting to me about this is that, well, so just for reference, if you're not an ocean modeler, to close any sort of normal ocean model's budgets of almost anything requires mixing up in this range, okay? So it's very interesting that the observations and theory would suggest that, at least in this the kind of this part of the tropics and subtropics, the mixing is significantly less than that.
Does that exclude the mixing from hurricanes? Does those be
well, so that's the important question, right? And this is actually part of the process I went through. I said, well, you know, people have looked at this stuff. So then I had to track down every single one of these references, you know, read about the actual field campaign that generated it, then plot up a hurricane map, and then, you know, talk to some actual oceanographers that I don't really consider myself one of those. And interestingly, but maybe not surprisingly, people who go on field campaigns avoid hurricanes, okay? So you can look, and I have, at every single tracer study that was published by these various authors over the years, and in every single example, and the famous Leadwell study, and some of the, you know, really some of the most important and influential studies that have been done on this, every single one of them avoided hurricanes. And there was one, Hurricane Edward, that came up the east coast of North America, and they did actually get a measurement in there, and it was 10 to 100 times higher than all their other measurements, and they threw the data point out. And if you read the paper, it says, well, this is what we got, but you know, this was a hurricane, so we're just going to ignore it through all the rest of the paper. So there's actually been an enormous amount of selective sampling. This is actually a really important issue. So I guess the way I would put it, I mean, just as something to think about, is that in the absence of hurricanes, it's entirely likely that the values are down here. Molecular mixing would be basically here. This is a little bit more than molecular, but it's way less than what's necessary to close any of the existing tracer budgets. And I would say that in the absence of hurricanes, you know, you could very well have values down here. Well, skip that. Another reason why this is all very important, and some of you will care about this and some of you won't. Some of you will be skeptical of it, some of you won't. It's fine. This is a schematic depiction of the stability, if you will, of the Atlantic meridional overturning cell or the thermohaline circulation. And there's these very well-known ideas that if you add a freshwater flux in the North Atlantic, you may actually shut down deep water formation in high latitudes. And there's a hysteresis and there's a bifurcation. And you know, this is all extremely well known, and people have historically been worried about it, although maybe now they're not nearly as worried about it, and probably for good reason. What's interesting is the size of this hysteresis loop and the existence of a bifurcation ends up being fundamentally, so this is a different conceptual model where you would just more or less gradually diminish the strength of the deep water formation and the meridional overturning stream function as you add fresh water. The difference between the two conceptual pictures of having this hysteresis loop and not having it ends up being entirely dependent on your background value of the vertical diffusion parameter. And you can show this analytically, which is cool, and you can show it in a more complex climate model, and you get more or less the same kind of behavior. So observe today a good background value for the vertical diffusion or diaphragmal diffusion would be about 0.1 centimeters squared per second. Historically, in GCMs, for various reasons having to do with the problems in GCMs, they used values 10 times bigger. And a lot of the simple models that have been used, because they don't really have a wind-driven cell, parameterized wind-driven circulation by having a really big value. Which is why a lot of simple models had this really nice bifurcation, and a lot of the better GCMs that are more accurate and represent the real world better end up having more or less a smooth transition. And you can, this is actually I think a beautiful result, that you can show that it's almost a singular limit, this high diffusion limit. So this is one of the many reasons why people who really care about the ocean really don't like it when you talk about high values of the vertical diffusivity. It's not measured. It does bad things to all of your fundamental things that you care about in the ocean. And it's a little bit like viscosity in the atmosphere. It's sort of a singular limit issue. And in this case,
molecular is 0.01 centimeters squared?
Molecular would, yeah, it would be less than 0.01. But it would be, yeah, maybe it might be 0.001, something like that. Is that about right?
Can you which of these curves are the measurements from the previous slide correspond to?
Okay. So this would be, remove four from this. Okay.
So 0.45 is even higher system.
Yeah, yeah. So when we're talking about 0.1, we're talking about these numbers in here. Okay. Yeah, sorry. It's, you know, go between MKS and CGS units all the time in oceanography, unfortunately. So these are high values. In terms of observations. I mean, they're not as high as the outside limits, but they're, for a mean value, that these are actually pretty high. And certainly in limited areas over a seamount or in on a very rough boundary, you can get higher values. But for a mean value, this is actually about as high as you want to go, maybe twice as big as that, but not more than that.
So what are these models?
These are, in this case, this is all the same model. I think this is actually from the UVic GCM. So it's, I'm not a big fan of the model. It has a crappy atmosphere and, you know, there's problems with it. But it's actually not bad for this kind of study because you can really explore a lot of the phase space very, very quickly and easily. And it probably can get this much reasonably right. Anyway. So now I want to talk about hurricanes. So the nice thing about hurricanes is that there's a fairly good theory that determines their potential strength, and you just treat it as a Carnot cycle, and you can make various estimates, and this is all the work of Carrie Emanuel and related work by Holland, but this is really particular ones, the theory of Carey. And what's kind of the all-important quantity for the possible amount of, the possible intensity of a storm is this difference here between the surface temperature and the outflow temperature. And once you know that, you have most of what you need to know to determine how strong a storm could possibly be. Now, whether it actually achieves that potential intensity is a subject of an entire another set of issues, and it may even be more or less, as far as we're concerned, random. But you can make some assumptions and do some math and realize that you can simplify that equation down to this very simple statement, which provided that this were essentially a constant, which it doesn't need to be, but could be, then you would be able to relate the potential intensity of a hurricane directly to these temperature-dependent parameters. And most of the time, this seems to work pretty well. So you can do this sort of calculation, and in an extremely simple kind of single column model, you do find that the potential intensity rises according to a rather simple function of sea surface temperature.
Assuming constant relative humidity or something for the enthalpy term?
Yes, I believe so. I mean, this is his 87 paper, it's quite old, but this basic result hasn't changed. And again, this is not to say the real world behaves this way, but just to say that we actually have a theory and we have simple models that reproduce the theory and they seem to match the observations to some degree. This is a paper by Knutson et al. You can go into, you can think about global warming and take the inferred temperature increase in of a doubled CO2 world and use that to drive some hurricane models which actually try and resolve the dynamics of these things. And you can estimate based on that, I mean, there's a PDF of possible wind speed, and this is just the mean, but you can estimate changes in potential, or in this case, actual intensity as you raise CO2 and raise tropical mean temperatures. This is not to say that the absolute value of this is correct, but just to say you have a theory that tells you what the sign of the change should be and roughly the magnitude. And when you use complex models, you get something like that. And this has nothing to do with how will shear change and how all the other interesting parameters might change to alter this. But this is really just focusing on the thermodynamic part of all of this. All right, so we need to eventually get to the concept of wind work on the ocean due to tropical cyclones. So it's helpful to just treat this thing power dissipation, which is really just the integral over the footprint of a storm of the velocity cubed, the surface velocity cubed. And there's a drag law in there, and there's some interesting things that can happen with a drag law, but we're going to ignore those right now. So hypothetically, you should just, if you knew the winds associated with a tropical cyclone, you could just add all of those up and estimate the power dissipation due to a tropical cyclone. And at some level, that has to be an estimate of how much the cyclone was interacting with the ocean in steady state. Carey published a really important, influential paper in Nature where he looked at trends in this quantity, and this really got a lot of balls rolling, good and bad, where he was relating trends in tropical sea surface temperatures with trends in this integral measure of the intensity of tropical cyclones. And it just happened to be the year that Katrina hit, so this all of a sudden blew up into something pretty big. He didn't actually have spatially resolved wind fields, so he just approximated PD with this thing, the PDI, the index of this quantity, where he's just using the best track wind fields. So these are products produced by various government centers, and you can go and you can just get the estimated maximum velocity associated with a tropical cyclone at any given point in time. And so you just did the integral of that. My student and I were really interested in this ocean mixing idea, but we decided to see whether we could reproduce Carey's trends in PDI using some other method. So we used a variety of different methods, but one of them was to use ECMWF reanalysis 40-year project winds, and actually try and calculate the real PD rather than the PD index by trying to integrate over the storm's footprint, all of the storm's footprints. And the interesting thing The blue line is Kerry's PDI trend, and these other lines are what we calculated from ERA 40. And until you get to about 1980, they're essentially the same. So in other words, even though he did various approximations to every aspect of the problem, when we did the same calculation completely independently, we got basically the same answer. Until you get to here, where they diverge. On the other hand, this is essentially when satellite retrieval started. So we can't say who's right before this period of time, but it's entirely plausible to me that we're certainly, that ERA 40 is certainly not necessarily right until you include satellites. And that includes satellite estimates of sea surface temperatures. So I think there's very good reasons to think that this is, from here on, maybe the model does okay, but before that, it's being fed the wrong inputs, so it's not going to get the right outputs. And if you plot up PD versus other things like temperature, you know, this is the correlation is not great. It's okay. It was interesting. At least there's a positive correlation that's useful for the kind of thing that I want to do with it. The year-to-year variability doesn't line up well, but if you low-pass filter it, it does. So this is 2 meter air temperature in the tropics, and this is two different estimates of PD.
But if you remove the trend, there won't be any correlation at all.
So there's a question of doing high-pass versus low-pass filtering, and we could break it out basin by basin. Let me put it this way. We could have gotten a much better correlation if we had tried. And that's, so we could pick the temperature in the region where the storms form or where they start, and we could just look at the Atlantic. There's various things that we could have done we could have gotten a much higher correlation, okay?
What's the difference between this graph and the graph from Kerry's paper where there was correlation in shorter time scales?
He does a 5-10-5 smoother.
Yeah, he did. Gives you these strong correlations.
Yes, they're the very strong. If you just look in the Atlantic, the correlations are very good without smoothing.
Also for your.
Yeah, even for ours. The Pacific, what's actually very interesting, and somebody should write a series of papers on this, is the mean sea surface temperature and Pacific PD are almost exactly anti-correlated on timescales less than 3 years, but are correlated on timescales more like 4 to 5 years. So there's interesting science that could be done with that. What we were trying to get at, again, down the road at this point, this was 2005 when we were doing this, was trying to see a functional dependence that could eventually be put into a model in some sort of stochastic way. So we were intentionally, let's blur our eyes and see if we could see a trend and not worry about the year-to-year blips, which actually we could pull out to specific basins. And again, this was actually buried in supplemental material, and I wouldn't make any big deal about this. This was not what we thought of, just a general indication. This is tropical mean sea surface temperature, and again, we could pick something that's more relevant to hurricanes, but we wanted some gross number. And this is PD, and the interesting thing is, you know, obviously, something happens. It increases. That's all that really mattered to us. We fit a linear fit, we could have chosen things that would give us better fits. We just wanted to say, did it increase or not? What's really interesting, though, is the fact that for a 0.25 degree increase, you know, a quarter of a degree increase in tropical mean temperature, this number goes up by almost a factor of 3. So now, is that statistically significant, that 3 number I just quoted? You know, absolutely not. I don't have enough data points, and are they truly independent? There's where all the difficulties are. I just wanted to know, are they positively correlated or not, essentially? And is it a strong dependence or not? So we've gotten a lot further. That was actually a study just to see, really, if Kerry's basic results were right or not. And the basic results were right after 1980. All right, so now let's talk about something that's much more to the matter. So when a hurricane goes by over the ocean, it does a number of things. Depending on the rate at which the storm is translating over the ocean determines the response, depending on its speed. Quite a lot of it goes into near inertial gravity waves. Some of it can go into a sort of an Ekman transport divergence based upwelling and downwelling feature. Some of what goes on actually gets fluxed out into the atmosphere and drives the hurricane, but we know based on at least 10 different studies that about 60 to 85% of, let me just show you the, that's what happens when you move a slide. About 60 to 85% of this thing, the cold wake kicked up by a hurricane, is due to vertical movement of water and not latent sensible heat fluxes through the top. This is a TMI, satellite retrieval of sea surface temperature. This instrument sees through clouds. For this particular storm, and we picked a good example, but not the only example that's this big, you have 6 to 8 degree cooling over something that's 500 kilometers by several thousand kilometers. And this is, again, based on modeling that's been done and also observations, this is almost entirely due to vertical mixing upwards of cold water and not latent and sensible heat fluxes through the top of the ocean.
Is this a snapshot of time or is it following the hurricane?
This is the hurricane. This is before, this is like 3 days before the hurricane and 5 days after, I think.
So it follows the hurricane.
Yeah. So it basically within a day of the hurricane arriving, and because of the details of the fact that this is an inertial wave response, it's usually to the right, up the upper right-hand quadrant of the storm's path. That's actually one of the neat things about this is you can it comes right out of the dynamics that it should be biased to the upper right-hand quadrant, and it's really neat that you almost always see that. All right, so you can relate the degree to which you get a geostrophic response or an inertial wave response based on the Froude number, or for people in other fields, you might call it something like a Mach number. And so this is actually something that you need to know for a realistic storm in order to determine whether you expect this thing to be kicking up a whole bunch of waves or just essentially doing Ekman pumping. But you can go and you look from mooring sites, you can actually see these waves. This is the zonal velocity at some depth. This is 45 meters, this is 71, this is 100 meters down the Bermuda station. This is results from Zedler et al. And you see these beautiful inertial oscillations at a variety of depths. And there's many, many, many observations of this. This is not just a one-off thing. They happen all the time. This gives you a better idea of what's actually going on. This is from a different site. This is from in the Pacific. The colored graph here is an indication wherever you see warm colors, warmer than yellow. That's an indication of where the critical gradient Richardson number is being violated and you're causing strong vertical mixing. Okay, so this is depth in meters. This is time. The storm happens at this location right about here. So you have something like a 40-meter mixed layer depth initially, and then the storm comes by and kicks it down to at least 120 meters. And this is actually one of the biggest, this is the biggest event they see in the entire field campaign for this particular property. They have various profilers and instruments that are drogued to density, and you actually see those things, you know, these kind of floats actually bobbing up and down by significant, you know, tens of meters. So this is, in this case, this would be a Lagrangian trace of what's going on rather than an Eulerian one. This yellow line is an indication of how the mixed layer deepens as the storm goes by. So it goes from about 50 meters down to 150, 170 meters. We're not going to talk about the geostrophic response so much. Climatologically, we have every reason to think that this is important. This is a particularly bad year. This is 2005. But I just want you to note that in the wake of almost every single one of these storms, there's this little blue blob. Right? I mean, There's a lot of these things. It's like they go over the warmest temperatures and then just erase them. That's actually, if I had to invent a way to keep tropical temperatures below a certain value, this would kind of be the way I would do it. I'd say, I don't like that. I'm just going to erase it.
But I don't think, that's a crucial point. Sorry to interrupt you.
Sure, you should.
You erase it for a time, and not necessarily for very long. And the crucial question here is how much of that is irreversible, how much of that is simply reversible by geostrophically slumping back. And the reversible part of it you wouldn't care about for the things that you or Kerry would be interested in here, right?
Right. That's a good point, and I will hopefully be touching on that. But I mean, I can just say it now that essentially what I'm showing right now, and for most of the rest of the talk, is just surface observations. And it will address in no way how much of this is essentially reversible. Now, there's two issues of reversibility. One is what the ocean does. And the other one actually has to do with if you really want to change the tropical mean state, you need to affect the top of the atmosphere radiative balance on some longer time scale. So another issue here is, are you actually changing the net heat put into the tropics or not? Which is also, and those are two things I will not be able to address with what I'm showing you now, and you really need modeling to do that. And that's what my student's currently working on, and other people are currently working on, like Claudia. So I think this is what all of us are interested in, so that's why, Jim McWilliams and my student and Raf Ferrari are trying to do this with Raf's new mesoscale mixing and submeso mixing parameterization to deal with exactly that issue. And in a couple months, hopefully we'll be done and we'll know. But in the meantime, this is all, I would think about this, everything I'm going to show you is probably an upper bound on the importance of this mechanism.
And so that's what I'm saying in Kerry's estimate, right? He assumes that the mixing to 100 meters is completely irreversible.
Yes.
And
I agree. Everything Kerry did and pretty much everything I'm going to show you is probably an upper bound on the importance of this mechanism today. And I think that's absolutely correct. So the way Kerry kind of thought about this mechanism is this is what an ocean temperature profile might look like before a storm. And then the storm comes by and basically takes that warm water, pumps it down. All right. Now, if, and these are observations, these aren't Kerry's made-up world, this is actual observations, if the storm goes by, the sun comes back out again, if you then heat the mixed layer up again, then you will have a column-integrated warm anomaly. And in steady state, the idea was however much heat was in this column-integrated anomaly had to be advected to high latitudes in order to be lost in steady state. Now, the reality is that's an assumption. There's a variety of other things that could have happened to that water mass. And so two of the questions are what happens to whatever integrated heat anomaly actually occurs, and how much of an integrated heat anomaly is there really? If it's all just pulling the water apart and then letting it slosh back again, the heat anomaly is zero. If the sun just heats up the upper millimeter, the integrated heat anomaly is also pretty close to zero. So it's a big assumption to think that essentially however deep you mixed the heat down, all of that goes into being heat transport. But that's a starting point. The way we dealt with it in our paper is we introduce a factor K, and K, if it's one, all of that heat that got mixed down goes to the poles, and if it's less than one, some fraction, and so then all you have to do is figure out what fraction K is. That will probably take 20 years. So one of the cool things about this is also with satellites, you can go in and see that in the wake of tropical cyclones, there is plankton blooms. Coccoliths, for example, just go crazy. And probably before the coccoliths go crazy, there's probably other species in the coccoliths are involved in the succession after the initial period. And so Lynn, for example, has estimated that about 30% of the total new production in the oligotrophic gyres is actually due to these cold wakes. This is actually a very good indication of the fact that the mixing is deep and is pulling, because that's where the nutrients are. So the mixing, you really do have to mix water from below the nutricline up to do this. So this is one of the reasons, I think actually one of the constraints ultimately is going to be coming from chlorophyll to determine how much real mixing is going on here and not just temperature. So let me just say that what we did was we looked at the footprint of a whole bunch of storms over, in this case, a couple decades, and added them up. And we added up all the cold anomalies, and in some cases the warm anomalies, added them up, normalized them so that it looks like a per year kind of number, and you end up with this figure, which is pretty enough to be in Nature. So it shows that assuming, actually this doesn't involve so many assumptions. This is just adding up all of the cold and warm wakes. You end up getting, say, this part of the ocean is 2 to 3 degrees colder than it would be without the tropical cyclone. There is a little bit of fuzziness there about whether, about that statement, because I'm actually saying something implicitly about the top of the atmosphere rated to balance. I'm assuming that there isn't then an anomalous change in the atmosphere that wouldn't be there without. But let's just say this is essentially just taking that movie that I showed you and adding up all the cold wakes and saying, yeah, well, if you have a bunch of storms and they decrease the temperatures by 2 degrees each, and there's a whole bunch of them, the temperatures are 2 degrees colder. I mean, in that sense, this is actually simpler than all the arguments about ocean mixing as far as the oceanography is concerned. And this ends up just being more of a tropical surface ocean thermostat. It says when temperatures get hot, you tend to have a hurricane, and that mixes cold water up from below. And that argument doesn't actually worry about or depend on what happens to that water next very much. For those of you who like to point out errors or weird things, you'll note this warm blob there, and I would tell you right now we have no good explanation of that, but it shows up in every analysis. In terms of an integral balance, this and this essentially cancel, so we can ignore that. And what you're left with is essentially cooling, 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 and then a little bit of warming, which is interesting. And you're always going to get some noise. Since I have a temperature change on an annualized, you can phrase this in terms of a watt per meter squared forcing, in which case you get with numbers that are 1, 2, 3 watts per meter squared, which is nice because it's not so big that we all should have noticed this before, but it's not so small that you could ignore it entirely. So if I have a temperature change and I know the background stratification and I know the time scale on which these occur, I can calculate an effective diffusivity in the upper ocean. And that's what we did. So this is just basically taking this map, using the Leavittis background stratification to estimate a depth of mixing, and then saying that this gets restored on E-folding timescales of about a day, you end up with a diffusivity estimate. This is just the bulk, simplest, easiest thing that I could do. It took me a year to figure out that I could do this, but you know, this was just meant to be, you know, kind of order of magnitude scaling estimate. What's really interesting about it, this is the zonal mean of that quantity, is it peaks at about 15 to 20 degrees with a mean value of about 0.3. The overall mean between 30 north and 30 south is something like 0.15 centimeters squared per second. It's exactly what I need in an ocean model to match the tracer budgets within this 19 degree C isotherm. In other words, the warm water sphere.
The time scale, it's a day, you're assuming?
I used a day, again, because it was easy, because it's a day. I can change this, you know, it's linear in time, right?
It doesn't, it just strikes me as a pretty short time scale. It is. Staying around for considerably longer.
So that's the thing, is that the time scale actually varies a lot. There are some cold wakes that are around for 2 weeks. There are some that are gone within 3 days. And I think, again, some of that has, my personal opinion, not having verified this, is that some of this depends on whether the energy goes into the geostrophic response versus the inertial response. But I picked a day because it was a day. And Rob Cordy picked a different number. He actually picked, I think, 12 hours. He actually, for his own reasons, picked an even smaller value. So again, you could move this however you want. What's interesting is I picked a day which seemed reasonable and I got 0.15. You also noted zero on the equator. That's really important because as anybody at GFDL will tell you, or NCAR, you don't get El Nino right in an ocean model if you put a lot of mixing near the equator. And so that's why they've always tried to tune their mixing down, 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 and they hate mixing. But this says, no, there's no mixing on the equator. It's concentrated in these regions. And just so you know, for those of you who aren't ocean modelers, ocean models tend to have the wrong mixed layer depths in these exact regions. They're too shallow. And the ocean modelers complain in their papers. They say, Gokhan Dhanabhasklu and Bill Large have a little complaint in one of their papers, and it says, it's as though the winds that the ocean model we're getting weren't strong enough. And instead of dealing with that issue, we're going to tweak the taper parameter in KPP to deal with that. And what I'm trying to suggest is that's probably exactly what's going on. In some sense, the winds that they're getting on average are not strong enough. Let's skip. Oh, no, I got to go to that because it's a nice straight line. I've never had a result in my life that was as good as this one. And I probably never will again, and it's probably wrong. But so assuming that all of the heat, all the cold that got mixed up corresponds to heat that gets mixed down, and then that gets transported to high latitudes, all of which could be incorrect statements. But just, again, to calculate a number, we can call this ocean heat convergence. That's actually pretty straightforward. I believe that number. If we say it's ocean heat transport, there's all those assumptions that go into saying that. It has units of basically 10 to the 14 watts. So 0.3 times 10 to the 14 would be 0.3 petawatts. Important thing to keep in mind is that the heat transport, say in the North Atlantic, which everyone tends to care about, past 45 degrees north is on the order of 0.1 petawatts. In the subtropics, it's, between 1 and 2 petawatts. Okay, so that's kind of order of magnitude numbers that you might be interested in. So what this says, again, making all those assumptions, is that for a quarter degree change in tropical sea surface temperature, the amount of heat being converged into the ocean by hurricanes went from 0.15 petawatts to 4.5 petawatts. That's a big change. That's interesting to me. And a low R squared, or high R squared, a low spread.
Does the time scale enter in this estimate as well? The rotation time scale?
What goes into the assumption is that the ocean heat convergence is ocean heat transport, and that happens on steady state time scale, so that would be, 30 or 50 years. Okay. So, we've done great damage to that.
That's what you're getting.
Oh, no, this has nothing to do with the time scale. This does not depend on the diffusivity.
Scale that enters.
Yes, so it has to do with rho CPV delta P. Yeah. In this case, we estimated it was 50 meters uniformly. We do another.
Deeper than the mean mixed layer there, right?
It tends to be. I'll show you a refined calculation in a second. So based on reviewer comments for the first round of reviews, I went back in this case, and I looked to see if there was any observational evidence at all supporting what I was showing, what we were showing. And I was very surprised that there was some. There's a nice paper by Ed Schneider and Uma Vaught where they looked at diathermal diffusivities through control volumes in the ocean. It's a beautiful paper using a dissipation integral theory that kind of goes back actually to Ed Schneider's paper on what he called Hyde's theorem and ended up becoming a nice theory for the tropical circulation that we now no longer believe. But it's a beautiful paper. Everyone should read it, but nobody has. Anyway, they estimate the diapicnal diffusivity, and they plot it versus temperature, and that's the black line. They show something rather odd. They don't remark on it, but it's odd to me. They show vertical diffusion going from a low background value. In this case, this would be high latitudes, okay, at low temperatures, and actually skyrocketing at higher temperatures, which is counterintuitive to me because higher temperatures, more stably stratified, I would expect vertical diffusion to go down. So they actually didn't remark on that too much, probably because they thought it was wrong. I don't know. And so that's the black line. If you just do the same calculation in just the Atlantic, you come up with this light blue line. All right. So I did the same thing. My estimate is totally different. I just took that map of diffusivity and broke it up according to the water mass classes. And you end up with the blue line if I just do the Western Pacific. green line if I just do the Atlantic, the red line if I do the whole world. The key thing is, oh, so just so you know, Schneider and Bott's Western Pacific plus global line at temperatures above 25 degrees is just in the Western Pacific, because that's the only water mass class. It only exists in the Western Pacific. So the blue line and the black line should be identical geographically in this regime. And interestingly, they're essentially identical numerically. Now, I didn't fudge anything. I didn't tune anything. This was just, again, I chose a time scale of a day. So that was very interesting. So another way of putting it is that all of the vertical diffusion in the upper ocean can be explained by tropical cyclones. That's not to say that that's true. I mean, as I was saying last time we talked about this, you can't mix something twice. So maybe something else is also mixing, and maybe this is mixing something that's already mixed. But this doesn't rule out anything, but it says that if we didn't know about anything else, we could explain it all with just hurricane, maybe. So we've refined these estimates with different estimates of winds and ocean heat content anomalies using different satellite data. All of our estimates have gone up as we changed our techniques. And now we're actually, rather than using the 50 meter constant depth assumption, we're now estimating that depth the same way I did with the diffusivity, saying, what's the temperature change, which is the standard stratification, that's the mixed layer depth perturbation. And we've verified it where we can with observations. You can get within 10 or 20 meters of in situ observations just by doing that simple trick. So if you do that, the ocean heat content anomalies are now these lines, and they go from being about 0.2 petawatts up to 0.4 petawatts just by allowing a better estimate of the depth to which the mixing occurred. So we're kind of happy about that. I'm not going to show this. Yeah, what?
I guess my zeroth order assumption there would be that whatever mixing goes deeper than the mean mix layer depth will restratify geostrophically. I'm just using the mean mixed layer depth, which would be, if you lower depth than what you had before, would actually be a better estimate of the irreversible mixing that in the end can go into transport or storage or.
Well, so, and that may be right. We'll see. Let me show you. Some of your questions will be answered in what I'm going to show you next. So this is the same map I was showing before, but now with a new instrument that sees through clouds, the magnitudes of everything are increased. The magnitudes of PD are increased. Magnitudes of the ocean heat content anomalies are increased. Everything's increased a little bit, essentially because these things see through clouds. We can estimate the mixed layer depth depression due to these things. And you're talking about climatologically deepening mixed layers in these regions by 50 to 80 meters climatologically. So these are big perturbations to mixed layer depth. So again, on our way to trying to develop something that we could potentially parameterize, this is PD on this axis. This is the per storm. So this is per storm now. So per storm PD, per storm heat convergence. We plot standard error and standard deev so that you can see how the sample size is affecting our estimate. This is the little thing you can't see here is the standard error. And this is the standard error because there's fewer storms that are big. But it's a pretty good fit. You know, R squared of 0.9 something. That's pretty good in my book. There's another way of looking at this, and that we plot that here. It's just the percentage within each per storm bin. What's the percentage of storms that are above category 3 in this case? We can also do this with 2, and it's the same picture. This is just another way of saying that the intense storms, these guys, really dominate the ocean heat convergence and PD. In other words, weak storms, this was actually a great confirmation to me because this is a totally different way of doing it. Weak storms, these ones and these ones, well, specifically these ones, lead to almost no cold wake, statistically speaking. So sure, any individual will, but the ocean heat convergence due to weak storms is almost zero. And strong storms do all the heavy lifting. It's kind of what we expect. And we can pretty much skip this, but using different instruments now, we have different functional dependencies of PD and ocean heat convergence. And you could essentially pull the slope off of this to develop some sort of statistical representation of this effect if you wanted to. We're getting quite large numbers. With the best estimates using TMI, SST anomalies, and quick scat winds, which are the two best ways of estimating this, we're now finding something like half a petawatt of convergence into the ocean of heat by tropical cyclones. All right, so now let's plot it up in this kind of Wunsch and Ferrari, going back to Monk and Wunsch diagram, to put it all in perspective in modern day. So the flux into basically everything by the winds is about 20 terawatts of energy, again, plus or minus 15% or something like that. And quite a lot of that goes into surface waves, which just basically spin around and do almost nothing. Okay, so this is from the Wunsch and Ferrari estimate, which, just so you know, when they did this calculation, they low-passed their wind fields. Nothing less than 5 days was included. So they don't have, so out of their 20, this is what we can calculate directly, or is due to hurricanes. So out of 20, well, sorry, in addition to 20, there's another 3 or so terawatts due to hurricanes. So again, it's a nice number in the sense that it's not actually negligible, but it's not the same magnitude as the mean wind field, right? Now, so what I can't do with what we've done is then calculate how much of it is going to internal waves. We didn't do that, we haven't done the modeling. But there's a really nice paper in press by Wang and Wang, where they use essentially a three-layer model, a mixed layer, a kind of shallow, reduced shallow water equation in the middle, and then a kind of a stagnant abyss. They've done that calculation. They came up with basically the same numbers we did for the wind part on the surface, and they estimate between 0.03 and 0.05 terawatts going into the inertial wave field. So the total in internal waves is 1.4 exajoules, which you can't see. 0.1 is coming in from the tides. And certainly many people think that 0.1 is coming into internal waves from tides. Many people think tides are important. This number is about half as big as tides. Again, I kind of like it. It says, it's not negligible, but there's a reason why people can easily miss it. It's about half as big as tides. But I actually think, in terms of modern day, I actually think this is going to end up being pretty solid. We got more work to do, but I think that will be pretty solid. Really, I want to give some credit to Johan Nielsen, who, when he was a postdoc with Carey, worked on this problem very hard, but unfortunately reached what we now know is the wrong answer, and that always bothered me. It's one of these funny things that Carey had forgotten that Johan had worked on this while he was a postdoc, and then wrote a paper and didn't even acknowledge that Johan had done this. But then, so after various things happened, Johan and I were talking about this, and he came up. He said that the number was negligible in this paper from 15 years ago, and it wasn't. But it was because he made an error, and it's just kind of funny. That's how science works sometimes. Sometimes people make mistakes. All right. So basically, to wrap up, let's just say vertical diffusion was stronger in the Eocene than it is today. And not say it's hurricanes, maybe it's tides, whatever. We don't know. Okay, let's just say that there was some source of mechanical energy that was doing vertical mixing in the Eocene. This is my standard is seeing case. It's not quite the one that cooks the tropics entirely, but it's still really hot. This is what happens when I increase vertical diffusion. In this case, this is by a factor of 5 throughout the column. So again, this is not hurricane-like. This is just me hitting the model with a big hammer to see what happens. This is what happens. The model without increased vertical diffusion is 3 to 5 to 7 degrees warmer in the tropics, and especially in high latitudes, 8, 9, 10 up to 15 degrees colder in high latitudes. In other words, adding increased vertical diffusion cools the tropics by 3, 4, 5 degrees and warms the poles by on the order of 8, 9, 10 degrees. And I would argue that we don't know what the vertical diffusivity is within several, at least a factor of 2 or 3 during these periods, especially since epicontinental seas, right? So the sea level was higher. So you had a whole lot more land covered with water, and it would all be very shallow. The tidal dissipation would have been different. If we're worried about any sort of wind work over continental boundaries, that term might have been different. It could all have been very different. So I think this is something that deserves further work. What's interesting is it also changes the global mean temperature, which is not intuitively obvious. So actually, the world warms by almost 2 degrees when you increase the vertical mixing.
Is there any numerical value of the diffusivity?
Right, so my standard case, there's a bit of a taper, but in the upper ocean, the standard case is 0.15. And then this is 5 times bigger than that, all through the column. So it's still less than what OGCMs were using for modern day 10 years ago. So it's not like I picked 50 or something like that. So to get to your question, how does ocean heat transport change? Well, it changes. And as far as I know, there's only like 3 studies that have ever been done looking at this. And this is the only one that I know of for kind of real, full GCM, fully coupled with all the bells and whistles. So the blue line is what the ocean heat transport was like before you mess with the vertical diffusion. Really looks like today, basically what happens. You add substantial vertical diffusion, and there's a bit of a change in the northern hemisphere, but all hell breaks loose in the southern hemisphere.
Isn't that then? But so if you increase the diffusivity in a model with current continental configuration, you would likely also get to large heat flux. Wouldn't that rule out this kind of model?
No, because what we're saying is that the vertical diffusion was probably higher in the past. No, I'm not saying probably. Higher. There's a chance that it was higher.
But now you increase it then. Even if you believe that hurricanes are important, then that would still be confined to tropical, subtropical regions, not to everywhere, right?
Not actually in the Eocene. So the other component to all of this is plotting up what maximum potential intensity and hurricane tracks look like in the Eocene. And when the poles are 25 degrees C, you actually, in my case, I'm getting hurricanes up to 70 degrees north and south. So, again, I'm 10 years away from saying anything definitive. This is just, hey, let's do it and see what happens. And what's interesting is it's certainly not the case that ocean heat transport is insensitive to vertical diffusion. It is sensitive. And the change can be large. It can be climate altering. All right, so I'm going to stop there. Come to this meeting. Any other questions?